Hey, welcome back to English History, Fact and Fiction, episode the 165th, Catherine Parr. My name's Dick Newman, and the excitement and buzz around the first presidential debate has died down, and some people declared Sleepy Joe the winner, while others, of course, went for the King as the winner. But I think the real winners in this are the American people. It was a magnificent display of your best and brightest out there, and an inspiration, I think, to everybody. Young women can be inspired and aspire themselves to, if they work really, really hard, becoming a grumpy old white man who can become the leader of the great nation. And other people can think, well, if I live long enough, I'll get that wisdom of the elders that these blokes displayed, and even kindergarten kiddies could watch it as a magnificent masterclass on good manners and decorum. So well done, USA. No wonder you are the leaders of the free world. And the best news of all for you is it doesn't matter which of these guys win because they are just both so magnificent. So Americans, bask in the glory that is radiated by your magnificent leaders. And of course, this is why the rest of the world is so totally envious of you. Let's get on with it. And you would know that that was Rick Wakeman with the track Catherine Parr. Last time, it was all about the short career of Catherine Howard leading to her and Joan Boleyn's death. I thought I might let you know about Lord Morley, Jane's dad, who had to, like so many others, just accept that his kid is gone, killed by Henry. Now, Lord Morley liked nothing more than to stay at home and read and translate. He'll now translate Boccaccio's De Claris Maleabibus, or Concerning Famous Women. It's a book about 104 exceptional women, starting with Eve, of course, yeah, Adam's Mrs. Eve, to Queen Joanna of Naples, who we met once a long time ago, my dear listener. Now, Morley will translate 46 of those stories and present an exquisitely decorated manuscript to Henry on New Year's Day, 1546. It's a no-hard-feelings gift. But perhaps there's a little tribute to Jane in that translation. It's in the Trojan War thing. And just to remind you a couple of things in that weirdo book, we had, at the start, Iphigenia, daughter of King Agamemnon, who he sacrifices so he can get the wind to blow the right way. That's what you do. If you need the wind to blow the right way, you sacrifice your daughter. Now, just for those of you who like a bit of revenge, Agamemnon's missus will get revenge when he finally gets home after whatever it is, 7 years. Agamemnon will take a bath and she will do him in that bath. He won't be getting back out of that alive. Fuck him. But before he could come home, the Greeks found the wind was blowing the wrong way again, so they needed another sacrifice to get the wind to go in the right direction. So this time they decided on Polyxena, daughter of King Priam of Troy, with Achilles' son, Pyrrhus, to do the job. Now Lord Morley would go off track at this point and whack in a sentence of his own. Oh, that it was against all good order that so sweet a maiden should be devoured by the hands of Pyrrhus, for to satisfy for another woman's offence. Yeah, so that sounds a bit like Jane dying for Catherine's offence. Then just to ram the point home, our Greek and Trojan princesses had to be willing sacrifices. So Boccaccio in his text says Polyxena offered up a throat, where Morley translates that she offered up a neck. Jane's reputation will be bad. She's the wicked woman of the story, both for helping Catherine Howard to be naughty, and her testimony then about her man George and his sister Anne Boleyn. Sir Thomas Wyatt will have a grandson, George Wyatt, who'll write a biography on Anne Boleyn, and he wants to present her as marvellous. Good, he should do. Part of this, though, will be his bagging of Jane Boleyn, suggesting she was a hostile witness. Yeah. With her death, George will say it was just punishment by law after a naughtiness. And that's the word he used, naughtiness. I guess at least he said she was naughty rather than wicked. These writings were done at the time of baby Betty, so of course we want to rehabilitate her dear mum. Of course her dad, our mad Welsh king, was marvellous, so he must have been misled by somebody into thinking that St. Leanne was playing around. And who have we got to point the finger at? Jane Boleyn. Besides, Jane Boleyn's brother's son, Jane Boleyn's nephew, shouldn't I? Jane Boleyn's nephew, at that time had just exiled himself for being Catholic, so the family name can get trashed. As we move forward in time, our historians work out that she and George had no kiddies, so therefore the marriage must have been crap. And why was it crap? Because George was busy banging his sister, and Jane's reputation is back in the crapper. I hope you, my dear listener, will be perhaps a little bit more sympathetic to dear old Jane Boleyn. As for Catherine Howard, well, it certainly seems that Henry was devastated over the whole thing. Chapuis, who by now has been with us for a long, long time, hasn't he? He's seen Henry go from a fit 40-year-old to a prematurely aged fat old monster. He was there when Anne Boleyn copped it. He was there when Jane Seymour died. But he will report that Henry showed greater sorrow at Catherine's naughtiness than all the false loss or divorce of his preceding wives. Chapuis, though, thinks he's got it figured. It's like a wife who will cry more over the death of a 10th husband than she did for the first 9. The reason for that is she knew that number 10 was the last. She's too old for an 11. Hey, is that psychology, Chapuis? Well done. Perhaps he's right. Perhaps Henry has worked out after Anne of Cleves and Catherine Howard that he is a old, obese and rather ugly man with a reputation now of killing 2 wives. Who'd want to have him? Oh, boo-hoo-hoo, poor me. Plus, Catherine Howard was the first missus to kind of abandon Henry. He finally knows what it's like to be dumped. And look, sorry, but to do this properly, we need to reanimate Catherine Howard for a tick. Happy news, she's alive again. Sad news, she'll get her head chopped off again in a tick. Chapuis will also kindly let us know that Anne of Cleves is sniffing around Henry. Crikey, this girl's got a great life. Nice retirement in the country. Why risk getting back together with a wife killer? Anne's brother, Duke Wilhelm, will write to Archie Tom Cranmer and Privy Seal William Fitzwilliam saying, hey, can you guys start whispering in Henry's ear about how great Anne would be as queen? Fuck no, they say. Last guy to do that had his head off. Do it yourself. In comes the Cleves ambassador to see Henry. Yeah, tell him to fuck off, says Henry. Then he goes to see the Privy Council. No way, they say. She's his sister. One last try with Stephen Gardiner, boo hiss. Stephen Gardiner will say, listen, dickhead, no fucking way will Henry take her back. Not a chance. 0, 0. Nothing. So,
suck my dick and choke on it. Fuck you.
Anne of Cleves will accept all this with the good grace that she has. Now, Frankie Big Nose's sister, Marguerite, who is now Queen of Navarre, will send Anne a portrait of herself and some advice. Sadly, we don't know what it was, but Anne will write back saying, thanks, but I don't need advice, nor prudence, nor patience, because my conduct is beyond approach. But thanks heaps for the portrait, and your request for one of mine. Now, Marguerite, you might recall, was a reformer, so was perhaps interested in a renewal between Henry and the German Protestants. Plus, it helps France if Henry is an enemy of Super Sausage Chuck. Henry, meantime, is still boo-hoo-hooing. Catherine's still alive, and he's boo-hoo-hooing, but is he going to go and see her or do anything? No, what a fucker. It's been going on for quite a while now. He will move around doing some hunting, listening to reports of the mopping up of the Catherine Howard stuff, but it'll be no business talk, thanks. The mopping up process includes the matter of going to Parliament, so on the 29th of January it will be dealt with, and of course the whole story gets rehashed and Catherine is the villain who hurt our poor Henry. And perhaps that will be the closure that Henry needed. Okay, he's over it, so he'll throw a dinner party. This is the first one he'll throw since he got the news that Catherine had been naughty, and it's going to be invite the cheeky babes. There will be 2 in particular that he's having a bit of a pinch and a squeeze of. Firstly, Anne Bassett, We think he's had her before, but it seems he doesn't think she's marriage material, so she's a bit of a dead end. And the other one is the young missus of Tom White, our poet. That's Elizabeth White, and people say she's just smart enough to perhaps get herself into a dodgy position and be kneeling before an axe man before you know it. But really, this is a dead end. Nothing's going to come of this. Okay, 12th of February, and sorry, Catherine, you're back to see the executioner. But at least Henry's over you, so there is that. A couple of days after Catherine's execution, and it's back to the feasting for Henry. 3 days in a row. Lots of invitees, lords and privy councillors on day one, lawyers on day two, and of course day three is Ladies' Day. Henry will even charm the ladies with one of his own songs.
Oh Lord, it's hard to be humble when you're perfect in every way. I can't wait to look in the mirror, 'cause I get better looking each day. To know me is to love me. I must be a hell of a man. Oh Lord, it's hard to be humble, but I'm doing the best that I can.
He's his charming old self, but he doesn't seem overly interested in any of them. People are wondering whether he'll go for a number six, and more importantly, is any girly game enough to marry the old fucker? The new legislation Henry introduced to stitch up Captain Howard means any woman has got to give him full disclosure of a previous, well, pretty much anything from a quick under the bra feel up to a full-on orgy with farm animals included, haven't they? Still, as we move into spring, Henry will make a decision. Catherine Parr is the lucky girl, and after a good hard think, Catherine Parr will say okay. Even though, my dear listener, I've got the gossip for you, she's in love with another man. Ah. Now, the Parrs were a bit like the Boleyns, a knightly family from the north who made good marriages to get ahead. Granddad, Sir William Parr, smartly decided to back Team Ted Four rather than Team Richard Neville, the Earl of Warwick. That gave the family a significant boost. Ted Four made William a garter knight and controller of the household. When William died, his missus married Sir Nicholas Vaux, which was great. The Parrs were Yorkists, while the Vaux were Lancastrians, so the combined family were well placed when Henry Tudor took over. After the mum died, the family became even more entwined with a double wedding. A Vaux boy and Tom Parr married sisters, or I should say wealthy heiresses, Anne and Maud Green. So Tom acquired Maud's inheritance rights, and now he's got lots and lots and lots of land. Plus, Maud's grandmother had been a lady to Marguerite of Anjou, Queen to Henry VI. The Parrs were also related to Sir St. Tom More through marriage. Henry VII had liked the look of Sir Tom Parr, and Sir Thomas done well in the getting of job scene. His Mrs. Maud got a gig as lady to Catherine of Aragon. Sir Tom could trace his family actually back to baby Ted, Edward III. He also goes back to Richard Neville, Earl of Salisbury, who was father to Warwick the Kingmaker. That line also takes him back to John of Gaunt, the son of Edward III. And some of the ladies of the family have also been ladies of the court then, so Tom will get the call up to go to court. The court thing is, of course, incestuous, and it tends to be the same families who get to spend time there. Sir Tom will get a gig as esquire to the body of Henry VII. These were the precursors to the gentlemen of the Privy Chamber. He will end up giving up the job to his brother, because he's a busy man going places. Sir Tom will spend a lot of time getting himself educated and thinks education is great. He wants the kiddies to have the same benefit, even the girlie of the family, Catherine. There's only the two kiddies, a girl and a boy. So Catherine Parr herself will be highly educated. The boy was that William Parr, who we met when we had the gossip about William and his Mrs. Anne Borchia, who didn't like William and eloped with a lover. Now Sir Tom had gone on the Frenchy gig back in 1513, where he was knighted, and he got to lead 100 troops. He got himself into the vanguard with Charles Brandon, Duke of Suffolk, and got nominated for a garter, but he failed to actually get it. He will, though, be made Master of the Wards. Now, they're the wards waiting to be allocated to somebody, and while they're waiting, Sir Tom gets their income. That's nice. Another promotion will come. Vice Chamberlain to Catherine of Aragon, which will make him a Knight Banneret. At this stage, he will get to be mates with Tom Boleyn and Stan. Sir Tom Parr will get a gig to go to Newcastle to bring Henry's sister Margaret Tudor, Dowager Queen of Scotland, to London. That's all going very well for him then. Just to increase your happiness, I can tell you that his marriage to Maud was happy. Then it's our baby girl, Catherine Parr. Catherine of Aragon will be the godmother. So Catherine Parr is the daughter of an up-and-comer. Sir Tom is now one of those guys you go to see if they can help you get a gig at court. One new boy who will go to Sir Tom is our old mate Sir Francis Briand, Vicar from L. Brilliant stuff, Sir Thomas Parr. November 1570, plague, dead. Catherine's 5 and her mum is 22. Now, fortunately, Sir Tom left both mother and daughter some cash, but it's a bit like Jane Boleyn. They have cash, but nothing like what they had when Sir Tom was alive. Maud Green, though, won't be remarrying and will become a lady of the court and devote herself to bringing up young Catherine and William. Maud will get a very good reputation with the raising of the kiddies and will soon have a kind of a school thing going on, and young noble types sent to her as boarders. Catherine will be good at the education stuff and will also learn the courtly manners, the singing, the playing the instrument, all that stuff that she needs. She's priming to be a courtier herself. Lovely upbringing for Catherine Parr then. 1523 and she's not even a teenager yet, but marriage dealings will start. We're looking at the son of Lord Scrope, but the Scropes were broke, so Lord Scrope was hoping for a substantial dowry. Maud will hold out for the amount of cash that he wants and eventually tell him to stick it. Now that's when Maud will turn her attentions to William instead of Catherine and marry him off to Anne Borchia when he's 14. Now that will cost Maud a fortune, but William is now married to an heiress of big stuff. And it puts William in line for the Earldom of Essex because Anne is the actual only heir. And if Anne's dad dies, Anne can't become the Earl of Essex, so there's a good chance the king will let her husband be the Earl, as long as the king likes him. Now that thing's called the Courtesy of England, where her husband can inherit his father-in-law's title, again, if the king likes him. Shame then that that marriage won't work. Maud had gone into debt, but she'd actually made a really good deal for a son. Trump would be proud of her. Although, of course, he would have made a better deal because nobody's better than King Donald at deals. Catherine will get her turn then at 17, once the William and Anne Borchia thing had been done and dusted. Enter Sir Edward Burr. Well, no, it's actually not anymore. It's about to change. It's spelled B-U-R-G-H, but we're now saying Burrough instead of Burr. So no more Edinburgh for me. It'll be Edinburgh from now on. Sir Edward Burrough isn't the sort of prize that Anne Borchia was, but he's okay. His ancestors include the Beauchamps and the Staffords, and he stands to inherit stuff, and what else can I tell you? Oh yeah, I might mention that insanity runs in the family. His granddad had never ever got the call up to go to the House of Lords. They said he was distracted of memory, that's what they called it. Yeah, he was nuts. The couple will move into the family home with the parents and there'll be, yeah, lots of I'm homesick letters from Catherine. Maud will go to visit and she can see the problem. You two need to move out on your own, get away from these fucking parents. Off they go for perhaps a bit of happiness with the couple moving into a modest manor, but on their own. Catherine will use her good education to run it and Sir Edward can just put his feet up. It will be 4 years of marriage, then sickly Sir Edward will just die. Now, luckily for Catherine, her in-laws won't be asking her to come and live with them. Catherine is a 21-year-old widow with 0 points in the baby-making department. Worse, Maud had died a couple of years earlier, so Catherine's a widow and an orphan. Still, Maud left her a nice big pile of dangly, sparkly jewels and plate and furniture and so on, so she's not broke. Enter John Neville, Lord Latimer, widower. He's 20 years older than Catherine. He's twice widowed with two kiddies. Now, this deal would have been brokered by her male relatives. John is part of those many Nevilles in the north. They might not be as powerful as they were, but they're still a force. John was also on the Frenchy gig in 1513, where he was knighted, like Catherine's dad. He was one of the investigators of the Holy Maid of Leominster. So now we're going to do that little story, just quickly. I'm not going down a rabbit hole. The Holy Maid of Leominster, also known as Elizabeth, no last name, just Elizabeth, and we found her in a loft above the chancel, which is the spot where the magician stands to do the magic show in the priory of Leominster. The prior told everybody that she'd been sent by God, and that she could survive without any food or drink except for the angel's food. That's the bread without yeast. More, she doesn't have to come down to get the bread without yeast because it magically flies through the air and straight into a gob. And we get to see this for ourselves during the magic show. Before you know it, we've got a cult. Old Margaret Beaufort was our person to investigate the cult stuff, so she'll convene a council, which includes our John Neville, to go out and investigate the Holy Maid of Leominster. Off they go up a ladder where they find a nice pile of, human shit. And that certainly does not smell angelic. And under Elizabeth's bed are plenty of meat bones. This isn't looking good for Elizabeth. But what about the flying bread without yeast? Oh, hang on, says one of our guys. What's this bit of wire going down to the altar? And there you go. Story turned out that the prior was banging her and needed somewhere for her to live. It will be a public penance for them.
Well, Jesus gonna be here. He gonna be here soon. They're gonna cover us up with leaves, with a blanket from the moon. With a promise and a vow and a lullaby.
Yeah, if Tom Waits tells you that Jesus will be here soon, then you can count on him. I'm sure it'll be any tick of the clock now. Catherine, though, is now Lady Latimer, the wife of a rich and substantial peer. She's the mistress of a large household and stepmum to a couple of kiddies. 3 years later, and it's going to be that pilgrimage of grace, and John and Catherine are in the north. So John will join the rebels. Oh, no. His land is very strategic for communication between London and the north. Archbishop Lee of York will see the danger. He's, of course, loyal to Henry, and he'll authorise Sir John to be in control of the Archbishop's men. Latimer will see that perhaps he should be loyal to Henry too, so he'll agree with the Archie of York. But the rebels will capture him, force him to swear their oath, and compel him to lead them. Having been compelled, Latimer will lead well. Off he goes to York, leading from the front. Lord Darcy will also be compelled to join the team and compelled to become joint leader. Now, Latimer was one of the guys to meet with Tom Howard, Duke of Norfolk. He'll ask Archie Lee to show their learning whether subjects might lawfully move war in any sort of case at all against their prince. Plenty of women also got themselves involved with the pilgrimage of grace. Catherine Parr will have nothing to do with it. She'll stay home and keep to herself. Very smart, Catherine. We do know that with Catherine, she had been very Catholic at one time, but at some point she joined Team Reformer. We just don't know when that happened, but she's not looking all that Catholic right now. Let's face it, it's the young people who embrace change, so perhaps she was already on Team Reformer. Although lots of historians decided it would be down the track from here a fair few years. Despite the pilgrimage of grace and the reputation of the Northerners, there were reformers in the north too. Lord Latimer will get the call to go to court with the pilgrimage of grace mob to meet Henry, but the order will be countermanded. Tom Howard has to go and subdue some rebellious types, and Latimer is ordered to give him a hand instead of going to court. Now, ordinary types will be suspicious that guys like Latimer are going to defect. So while Sir John is away, smelly types will visit his house just to take an inventory of his goods. Latimer will get the news and will write to Privy Seal Fitzwilliam. Smelly types are threatening to destroy my house if I don't go there. If I don't please them, I don't know what they may do to me, my missus and kiddies. Latimer then is in the middle of Henry and the smelly types with neither side trusting him. Now poor old Catherine Parr, of course, she's at home there facing the mob on her own. Sir John has another problem that he might only just be seeing. He had engaged his daughter to Ralph, the son and heir of Sir Francis Bigod, and you know Sir Francis is about to take control of the rebellion. And once again, ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, we see strange religious stuff. Yeah, well, it's all strange, really, I think, to me. Sir Francis Bigod was on Team Reformer, as we're pretty sure were John and Catherine. But Bigod was not into this particular guy, Erastus. Now, that's Erastus, not Erasmus. Erastus had said that sin should be punishable by the state and not the church. So, of course, Henry thought that was great. But Bigod, being a strong reformer, decided to go with the Catholic mob because they didn't also like Erastus. Yeah, it's all crazy, isn't it? Bigod didn't go straight to the rebels. He had sensibly decided to get out of town, but bad weather, a ship blown back to shore, and like all those other nobles, he was forced to take their oath and join them or die. Bigod had seen through the English Reformation. The removal of the Pope was the objective, and having achieved that, Henry was just using that extra power to become a bit of a tyrant. So Bigod wrote a treatise on what power should go to a bishop, a king, and a pope. And that might be the real reason why he ended up scoring the chop. At least Bigod held the view that Henry shouldn't be the head of the church in common with Lord Darcy and Robert Aske, but he disagreed with them in military tactics. Darcy and Aske truly believed Henry would do the talky stuff, but Bigod thought not. It was actually that disagreement that kind of caused the rebellion to fizzle out. But Bigod wanted to proceed with the military stuff, and you know the rest. Tom Howard comes in and they all run away. Now, nobles will be executed, but what about our Lord Latimer? It's not looking good, because Tom Howard will write a thank you note to Cromwell for information provided by Cromwell's spies, and include in that little letter, "The king does not much favour Lord Latimer." "How should I deal with this guy?" asked Tom Howard to Tom Cromwell. Cromwell will say, "Trick him into coming to London." Latimer gets that he's in trouble. In he comes, and he'll be arrested at Oxford. Latimer is loaded, so he'd be a nice target for a bill of attainder. Catherine Parr, though, is nicely out of this mess. For her, the king is just and virtuous. It must be. God appointed him. She will even write that Henry is our Moses, who has delivered us out of the captivity and spiritual bondage of the Pope. He's a Messiah who has taken away the mists of error and brought us to the knowledge of the truth by the light of God's word. Now, if everybody thought like that, the match factory would be out of business. Nobody would be getting burned. Still, it's also her writings that will handily help out a man, Lord Latimer. Also helping out Lord Latimer will be a nice big fat bribe to Tom Cromwell. Even better than the mysterious hand of God, that stuff. Also helping out was that Catherine's family had stayed loyal. Her uncle William had been Charles Brandon's right-hand man in the Lincolnshire Revolt, while her brother was with Tom Howard, Duke of Norfolk. Lord Latimer's defence, then, is that the rebels had forced him. His wife and kiddies were at risk, and that he didn't get into the subsequent Bigod rebellion. Tom Howard will speak in his defence, and there you go. Now, Catherine's brother will get a reward. He'll become a Lord, a Gartonite, and a Lord Warden of the Western Marches. Nicely done, lad. Also in the family scoring is Catherine's sister Anne. She will get a gig as one of Jane Seymour's ladies. She can marry well and stay on to be one of Anne of Cleves' ladies, becoming chief gentlewoman of the Privy Chamber. And she'll continue that on to Catherine Howard. It's going well, isn't it? 2nd of March, 1543, Lord Latimer is off to the Angels. They made it to 50, so that's not so bad for the time. Catherine will score a couple of manors and cash to continue raising his daughter. That's now two marriages and no kiddies, and Catherine is now 31. She's also, though, what we might call desirable. And Catherine herself is desirous of Tom Seymour, brother of Jane Seymour and Ted Seymour. He's dashing and dangerous. What's not to like? She'll write to Tom saying, "I am at liberty to marry you," suggesting that the two had met and perhaps explored some mutual admiration before Lord Latimer had died. Yeah, that's a bit naughty there, Catherine. Will it be Tom and Catherine, true love forever? Well, we've got that powerful force there, Henry. Henry must have had his eye on Catherine because it will be only a few weeks after Latimer's death that he'll propose to her. Oh, that's a dilemma now. Catherine's in love with Tom, but you can't really say no to a king, particularly fucking Henry, Jesus. Mm. Catherine will ask God for divine guidance. God says, pick Henry. Oh, fuck it, says Catherine, try again. No, says God, I said Henry. Letter to Tom Boleyn. God wouldn't back down, so I had to. He made me renounce utterly my own will and follow his most willingly. Okay, thinks Catherine, God has made me marry Henry, so there must be a plan. And the plan must be that I shall bring about the true reformation in England. Is that a bit dangerous, that sort of thinking? There may have been something else at play in Catherine's decision. Tom had been sent to Ferdinand in Austria to watch the sausages unsuccessfully take Pest back from Suleiman the Magnificent. So Tom came home just as Latimer was dying, and he should have been allowed to stay home for a while. He's just back from a mission. Henry will have him straight off to Mary of Hungary, daughter of Duke Phil John Legend and Mad Wana. Certainly looks like Henry wanted him out of the way then. Yeah, Henry's got Tom Seymour out of his life. Now, certainly by June, the word's out that we've got a new power couple. Catherine had told her brother William, and our John Dudley, Lord Admiral, and the new Lord Lyle, wrote to William saying, "Both your sisters are now at court." And just to clarify for us, that would be sister and sister-in-law. But, you know, the deal back then, it's magic, so both sisters. 10th of July, and Archie Tom Cramer will issue the marriage licence, and 2 days after that, the ceremony will be carried out in the Queen's privy closet. Catherine Parr is Queen of England. Congratulations. Now we'll need to check in on our new girl, Mary of Guise. We left her in blissful happiness in Scotland, having given birth to a boy, Jim. That's consolidated her already good position as Queen of Scotland and increased her street cred among the nobility. 4 months after the birth of little Jim, Mary is up the spout again. Well done, that Queen. How Henry must be fuming. Yes, it's all happiness for Mary of Guise, so it's time for the universe to make her pay, and pay she will. Bit of a hiccup then in Scotland, when perhaps paranoid King Jim V will turn on one of his oldest mates, Sir James Hamilton, and accuse him of treason. Nobody's got the foggiest idea what this is all about, including me. It's just a charge of treason, with no details, and a summary execution. That will give Jim V lots of nightmares where Sir James is back from the dead to kill him. Is Jim turning into a bit of a Henry? Now, fortunately for Mary, she can hang around Falkland Palace being pregnant, while Jim and the boys give her a bit of peace and quiet by going on progress. And she can keep busy overseeing the renovations of the palace. And Mary will miss out on her sister Louise's wedding. That's a bit sad. On the plus side, here comes that next baby. It's a boy. Henry must be spewing. This one can be named Robert after our mighty Scots hero, the Bruce. It's all celebrations and fireworks, and a week later, the happy couple get a message that baby number one, Jim, is not a well baby. Now, Mary hadn't been churched yet after the birth, so she's restricted to quarters. Jim 5 will do the mad dash, 52 miles, to get to his son. Too late. Baby Jim is dead. Jim 5 is boo-hoo-hooing, understandably, when he gets a message that newborn, Robert, is now also seriously ill, and Mary is frantic. Another mad dash overnight, but that's it. The two boys were dead, one day after the other. Oh, I should have warned you, my dear listener, to have your tissues ready. What a terrible blow for Mary. Isn't that awful? Married to a guy whose brain chemistry may be a bit fucked up, and this event would test anybody rather severely. The babies will be buried together at Holyrood Abbey in a very low-key event, family only. Word is out and about. Was it poison, is the word. King Jim V is being remarkably calm about the whole thing, and Mary's mum Antoinette will write soothing letters that nobody would poison two dear, sweet, innocent babies. And it was just God saying, okay, enough time on the planet for you little kiddies, back to heaven. It's going to be a rocky road in the relationship. Apart from the death of the babies, Mary has to deal with Jim's paranoia and depression, while he has to put up with Mary and the Frenchy ladies doing a bit of the courtly love thing, and that's made Jim jealous. What a dick. English spies are reporting to Henry that Jim won't be thinking about a war with England. He's just too busy being jealous. September 1541, and Jim and Mary have been invited to York, you know that, to meet Henry and Catherine Howard. Nice, but of course you already know they won't be going. Tensions have been increasing between Jim and Henry because Jim won't give up the Pope, and Jim's also really in thick with Frankie Big Nose. Frankie has taken to calling Jim his son. Now, Frankie will write to Jim saying, don't meet Henry. And had Jim's ambassador, Cardinal Beaton, in to say, make sure this doesn't happen. I don't want that meeting. No need to worry because paranoid Jim thinks it's a ploy and Henry wants to catch him and toss him in the slammer. Plus, he doesn't want to upset Big Nose anyway, so no, he's not going to meet Henry. Jim will skirt around the issue with the English envoy, who is still Ralph Sadler. Yeah, he got to keep his job. Henry will get to York and hang around. Absolutely no word from Jim, who is hunting at Falkland Palace. Henry has been snubbed and is in a real tizzy. That could be bad news. A few weeks later, and Jim will get the word that his mum, Margaret Tudor, is in a bad way, after having a stroke. Back on the fastest horsey thing, but once again, too late. And there goes another one out of our story. Goodbye, Margaret Tudor, another happy English princess there. Henry is now the last kiddie of Henry the VII and Queen Young Betty of York. Jim will outwardly be the mourner of his mum, but he'll ignore a couple of items in a will. One was forgive Archie Douglas. That'll be a no way from Jim. Archie's a fucker. And send my jewels to my dear daughter Margaret Douglas. Also a no from Jim, because Margaret is living with Uncle Henry in England, so fuck her. Jim will have a state funeral for Margaret and he'll pay for it himself. Margaret Tudor died pitifully broke for a Princess of England and a Queen of Scotland. Mary, of course, was a bit fond of the old chook Margaret, so there's another rift between her and Jim. More, of course it's going to be worse, you know it's going to be worse. Jim's out on the banging again, looking for nice hot Scotty chicks to bang. And look, the reality is, that's what these guys do. These kings are going to get out there and bang hot chicks. Their wives need to put on a brave face and put up with it. But there is another side to the deal, which is that husbands are supposed to be discreet about it. They're supposed to pretend they're not doing it. And we all need to pretend that nothing's happening. And then the queen can be nice and discreet and chin up and all that sort of stuff. But Jim is failing totally in the being discreet, and that's an insult for his queen. It's insulting, Jim. We do have a letter from Jim to Mary at this time. We don't know what he's replying to, but he does ask her to not be so thundering until you know the truth. Now, I'm not reading any happiness in there if he thinks Mary's thundering at him. Let's hope they have make-up sex and, oh, seems they have. Mary's in the family way again. This will be Mary's fifth kitty, with sadly only one surviving so far. But the point is, all her pregnancies have been a total breeze until now. This one is difficult. Must be a girl. Or maybe it's the tensions ramping up between Jim and Uncle Henry. Two big swinging dicks and one has snubbed the other. Their main link, Margaret Tudor, is dead. And Henry's been humiliated by Catherine at this time, Catherine Howard. So that's when he's got the Axeman in for her and Jane Boleyn. And nothing is happy for either Jim or Henry. Scotties will start border raiding and English will repay the favour. That's looking like it's going to be war. Henry is in no fucking mood to be dissed by his tick of a nephew. Henry is getting his clerks out to find documents to prove that he is the King of Scotland's overlord, so that Jim will need to come and do the homage bullshit. We haven't done homage bullshit for ages, have we? But Henry wants it back. Yeah, so fuck, we're back to that shit. Still, Henry will tell Chapuis there's not much chance of a war because I'm sure Jim will come and see me in London. What he didn't tell Chapuis was that he was trying to make sure that would happen because he's got kidnappers getting out and around. Jim will say, look, sure, I'll come to London, but just wait until my missus has dropped our latest sprog. Now, for Mary, it's more bad news. Time did the universe have turned on her? Her sister Louise has died, and Mary's worrying about an English invasion, and Jim's planning to invade England in any case. He won't. Scotty nobles aren't interested in going off to die. Besides, Henry had a lot of the nobles in his pay. November 1542, and Henry is getting his troops ready to go and give the Scotties a good belting. Duke of Norfolk to run the show. He's looking at 18,000 soldiers and 6,000 horse. And Henry's declared war, saying that he is the King of Scotland. This is getting out of hand, as it does. King Jim V will decide to get the jump on Henry and invade England, even though a lot of the nobles won't be supporting him. He's got 17,000 guys and reckons he can catch the English on the hop. Off he goes on a surprise motherfucker raid. And let's meet Sir Thomas Wharton at Carlisle. Sir Thomas will muster 3,000 guys to go and meet the 17,000 Scotties and do them right over. King Jim V had, unlike his dickhead dad at Flutton, decided to keep out of the action. All he can do is watch from a hill while his guys are trapped between a river and a bog and surrender. 23 of the nobles who had joined Jim in that little venture will now go to London at Henry's pleasure, where he can use them as hostages against Jim being a good boy. It's not the disaster of Flutton, but it's still pretty bloody humiliating. Jim, of course, is back to being depressed and looking for people to blame. Still, Christmas is coming up and celebrations will be prepared for Falkland Castle. Hopefully that might cheer Jim up. Maybe you'll get a nice present, a train set or something. Mary is in the safety of Linlithgow Palace with that bun just about fully baked. Jim will pop in on his way to Falkland and Mary will be shocked. He will be bedraggled and miserable and exhausted, and all he wants to talk about is crushing his enemies, both Uncle Henry and naughty Scotty nobles. 6th of December and Jim will arrive at Falkland. Supposedly that's going to cheer him up. But he's ranting. Worse, he's feverish, and he's spewing his heart out. Oh, fuck, now he's delirious. Dr. Dick, the podcaster, will say this is either typhoid or could even be cholera, but probably typhoid. You get both of those the same way. You get dysentery, hanging around a large group of men, say 17,000 Scotty troops with poor camp hygiene. Of course, in the 21st century, simple vaccination, and you'll never get either of them. A messenger will be sent to Mary, but she's in labour, and again she's failed to count correctly, or this baby is pretty premature. For the Scotties, what they really, really, really need right now is a boy, with Jim V looking a bit crook. Jim's Crooker's a dog, and oh no, he's pretty much dying. So an heir to the big chair would be terrific, thanks, Mary. Now, Jim's already had 10 boys and one girl, and Mary's had 4 boys and no girls, so the odds are really with us. What's your money on, my dear listener? A girl, you say? Yeah, girl it is. Bugger. 7th of December, 1542. And just a little item here for lady listeners. After your childbirth, you get a drink. That's nice, isn't it? Wine with sugar, spices, and a nice raw egg. So you demand that next time you have a dear little precious baby. Scotland is not in a good place. Unless Jim can recover, the only thing standing between happy Scotland and a civil war is a newborn baby girl. Time to get baby Jesus on the case. Please, baby Jesus, fix him up so he can continue to reign gloriously over us. Sorry, baby Jesus is busy right now, but he'll get back to you. No, he won't. 1 week later, 14th of December, King Jim V will take his last breath. Oh, my dear listener, do you recall the introduction to Mary of Guise? What a marvellous happy tale it was. Well, it's all turned to shit, hasn't it? Yeah, the Fab Four there reminding us that life has its ups and downs, and it's certainly a downer for the Scotties. The nobles were all thinking about 28 years earlier, when Dad Killer King Jim IV got done and 17-month-old Jim V took over. We have lots of belting over who would be regent and Margaret Tudor fucking shit up, and we really don't like the idea of doing this all over again. Our 27-year-old Mary of Guise, though, is no Margaret Tudor. This girl is switched on and will do what it takes to protect the rights of a daughter. Let's get her baptised, though, so we can name her, and it's Mary, Queen of Scots. Our mad Welsh king will be most happy to hear that Scotland is now under the care of a baby. And even better, it certainly looks like Mary was premature because she's sickly. People don't expect her to live. In fact, Chapuis wrote that neither Mary, mother or daughter were expected to live. Still, Henry's got a plan. So he's going to fetch those Scotty nobles who he was holding and say, look, how about you agree that Mary marries my lad Ted? That would tidy up the England-Scotland thing with Ted becoming king of both. They're cousins, but Archie Cranmer can approve that. It will be wine and dine the Scotties to show off our wealth and then get a promise from them that they will do everything they can to secure that wedding and send baby Mary to England for Henry to raise her. It's all happening in Scotland too. Margaret Tudor had gotten to be regent because Dad Killer King Jim IV had left that instruction in his will. He said that's what he wanted, Margaret Tudor to be the regent. Jim V's will says nothing about it, so some people think that the next in line to the missing stone at Scone should be the Lord Arran to be regent, and that Mary should marry his son to make sure that Henry doesn't get her. Mary seemed to accept that Lord Arran should be regent, but in comes Cardinal Beaton, and you might recall there was some doubt as to whether Lord Arran might be a bastard. No doubt for Cardinal Beaton. No, he's not fucking having this. No bullshit. No Lord Arran, thanks. And hey, look, I've got Jim's real will with me, which names 3 lords and me to be regent. Lord Arran will be totally pissed off and had to be restrained in the meeting, or he might have made Cardinal Beaton a dead cardinal there and then. It will be back and forth with Arran winning the debate, and Cardinal Beaton can get the chancellorship as a runners-up prize. and Mary gets the consolation prize of being in possession of baby Mary. On the unhappy side, Lord Aaron is unhappy that he doesn't have custody of baby Mary. He will now place spies in Mary's household and intercept all correspondence. Nasty there, mate, because in Europe the gossip is that both Marys are dead, mother and daughter are both dead, that's the gossip, and with no word coming, that's what it looks like. Mary's uncle, Cardinal Lorraine, will manage to get a letter through saying, "We all love you, Mary." At least she knows the Frenchies haven't forgotten her. No way. Her dad, Claude, is intending to go to Scotland to pick the girls up and take them back to France and fuck any Scotty who tries to stop me. Now, that's alarming for both Henry and Lord Aaron. Henry will send another one of those Scotty noble hostages back to Scotland to see if they want to join forces against Claude. And don't forget to tell them how good a marriage would be with Prince Ted and that baby Mary would be way better off with me. No point, Henry. Lord Aaron doesn't have Mary to send to you. And Mary Agee certainly ain't going to do that. Mary Agee has recovered and she's back in action. Despite Aaron's efforts to keep her in the dark, she knows what's going on both in the Scotty court and in the negotiations with Henry. She has a support team and is a big fan of Cardinal Beaton, who can tell her everything. Cardinal Beaton wants baby Mary to marry the Earl of Lennox, and Mary will allow him that fantasy because he's the best bet to keep baby Mary away from Henry. Great, but now Aaron is suggesting that Mary of Guise go to England herself to marry Henry. Yeah, he's in between wife 5 and wife 6 at the moment, so he's an available bachelor once again. Mary and Cardinal Beaton, meanwhile, are writing to the Earl of Lennox, who is in France, saying, "Hey, you want to come home and belt up Aaron? We'll give you the governorship of Scotland and you can marry Mary, Mother Mary, that is." Mary will move to Holyrood Palace to try and be a bit closer to the action. Not sure why, because she's got no role on the council and won't be able to do a cracker when Aaron arrests Cardinal Beaton during one of the meetings. Mary will go back to Linlithgow, so she's isolated again, but it's a nice fortified building. The gossip is out that some nobles are planning on kidnapping baby Mary to deliver it to Henry, or worse, murder her. Oh, that's not nice, murder a baby. But they want to make Aaron king. Mary will say to Aaron, "I'm just going to move into Stirling Castle for a bit." "Sure," says Aaron. But then back on the scene is our Archie Douglas, Jim Fyfe's hated stepdad. He'll say, "That's a dick move, Aaron." So Aaron will say, "Nah, you stay at Linlithgow." And it will now be close confinement. Word's out that a dad, Claude, is on his way with a massive army. In comes our man, Ralph Sadler. Henry had sent him to find out firsthand what the fuck's going on up there. He's already met the nobles, who weren't very forthcoming, so now he's in to see Mary. Aaron had told Ralph not to trust Mary, total Frenchie, and will always be on Team Big Nose, and she's a big fat liar. Ralph will then be surprised when Mary says it would be super terrific if baby Mary marries Prince Ted. "Hey, Ralph, I might have been born a Frenchie, but I'm a Scotty now, and it would be brilliant if baby Mary can be the princess who would bring an end to all this biff between England and Scotland. You know, Ralph, I hadn't worked out why God had done his mysterious ways thing and given us a girl, but this is obviously what it's all about." Now she can turn on the charm, win Ralph over, and slip in stuff like, "Aaron is an untrustworthy, greedy bastard. He's only interested in himself," that sort of stuff. "Look, all that bullshit you heard about I'm crook and baby Mary is sickly is obviously not true, because see for yourself." Rumour started somewhere, no doubt Aaron, because he's looking for us to be made dead and then blame sickness for it. And who would benefit from that? Aaron would. It seems from Ralph Sadler's writings that baby Mary had indeed come a long way and was by now your normal chubby baby bouncing girl. Ralph will report to Henry that it is Mary he trusts in this particular mess. Yeah, he might not be right there, but anyway, Ralph, good for you. Mary is actually looking to get Cardinal Beaton out of the slammer and is waiting for the Earl of Lennox to turn up with the Frenchy troops. Frankie Big Nose had said he could go rather than a dad, Claude. And look, here comes Lennox, and hey, two of Mary's supporters have sprung Cardinal Beaton. Now, Lennox will also be totally charmed by Mary, and she now has a hard man protector with a small army. Aaron will have a crack at kidnapping baby Mary, but that will fail. The nobles fighting in Scotland is pretty common, as I'm sure you know, so we still do other stuff while it's going on, and while all the bullshit's going on, they'll make a treaty with England, Treaty of Greenwich. This is peace for the England and Scotties for the entire lifetime of our 8th Henry and his grandniece Mary, baby Queen of Scots. And that when baby Mary is 11, she will move to London to marry Prince Ted. In the meantime, Scotland will be run by fucking Lord Arran. Now, the population will not be happy with this. Just an excuse for the English to come in and run the show, they think. Ralph Sadler will be attacked on the street, and the Earl of Lennox is happening to get his troops in order. Word's out now that a Frenchy fleet has been spotted. Arran is worried that the fleet is there to slip Mary and baby Mary, Queen of Scots, off to France and totally out of his control. He's been listed as being on Team Henry, so the Frenchies won't want anything to do with him. But hey, perhaps the Scotties and English should get together and be friends. After all, they are sharing the island of Britain. Now let's interview a Scotty and see what he thinks about the idea. I assure you that our nation will never agree to have an Englishman king of Scotland. And though the whole nobility of the realm would consent, yet our common people and the stones in the street would rise and rebel against it. Yeah, okay, let's forget the idea of a English king of Scotland. Time for Arran to lay siege at Linlithgow. Mary will get a message out to Lennox and Cardinal Beaton that Stirling help wanted. In comes Lennox, and Arran has cannon, but for some reason he can't use them. Who knows, wet powder maybe, forgot to bring the gun crews. So it'll be the talky stuff, and we agree that Arran can rule, but he must have a council. Archie Douglas will have to be booted back out of Scotland, and baby Mary will be allowed to move to Stirling Castle under the supervision of four guardians. Off they go then to Stirling, and the guardians will be Arran's guys, but Mary will surely be able to charm them. She's charming. And she has Lennox, who thinks she will marry him soon as the mourning period is over. Mary, under the terms of a marriage contract, could have gone home to France, but she's here for Scotland. 9th of September 1543, and baby Mary is just 9 months old, and we'll get the silly hat of Scotland. It's the 30th anniversary of the death of her granddad, Dad Killer King Jim IV at Flodden. Is that a good day to get a silly hat? Well, it's a grand affair, according to the Scotties. Cheap and tawdry are the reports that get to Henry. Baby Mary will scream and yell when Beaton pours on the holy oil. You should have warmed it up a bit, you dick. Arran and Lennox will carry the sword and scepter. It's nice to see them playing nicely together, but really, Arran realised he was in a shit position, so has given up. Told everyone he was giving up the English Protestant stuff and said no to Henry on the proposed marriage between his son and baby Betty. Now Mary will have Ralph Sadler in, probably to show him that she is now the Castilian of Stirling Castle, and to spin him some more stuff about how great it'll be when baby Mary marries Prince Ted. She might be fibbing there. Mary is waiting for a new dolphin to turn up in France. The actual dolphin, Frankie Jr., had died aged 18 unmarried. Allegedly poisoned, but the guy who confessed had been tortured, so maybe not. His younger brother Henry, who is married to Catherine de Medici, is now Dolphin, and Mary is patiently waiting for them to have a boy who can marry baby Mary. Trouble is, Catherine de Medici is buggering about and not getting up a spout. What an naughty girl. Frankie is being urged to get a divorce, even though she's using the top, latest scientific and medical methods to get her baby machine oiled up and working. You ready for this, my dear lady listeners? Just in case you are having a bit of trouble getting up the spout yourself, you may want to give this a go. You grind up some cow shit and stag antlers. Rub that in your girly bits. Maybe that's just to prevent Henry from going oral on her. And then you have a nice, long, cool drink of mule's urine. Now, given that all mules are sterile, I'm quite failing to see the logic here, but there you go. That's what you get when your society is up to its ears in magical bullshit instead of reason, logic and science. Now, you're probably wondering how Catherine de' Medici got on. Well, let me tell you that the clever girl actually got in a doctor who actually knew something. He's going to have a good hard squeeze at his and hers boys and girls bits. And he's going to notice something's not quite right. And sadly, I have no details at all. Anyway, he will explain to them how they need to do it to get the boy juice in the right spot. And Henry and Catherine are on the road to 10 kitties. In the meantime, Henry has, of course, fallen in love with his mistress, Diane de Poitiers. Might be because Diane was a bit rare for a girly type. She was into sport, which was not done for girls at the time. She's into swimming, tennis, riding, and became super fit. Plus, she's really smart. It might also be a bit of a mummy thing. Diane was 35, while Henry was 15. And that will be handy for Henry, having a smart mistress to help him run shit. And I'm off track. Point is, Mary is, at the moment, waiting for Henry and his Mrs. Catherine to learn how to do it properly, to get a nice legit dolphin to marry baby Mary. Baby Mary, having got the silly hat, is now secure as Queen of Scotland. So Mary de Guise can relax and Stirling Castle will be all happy with the courtly love stuff. Great. Mary is still young, so there's lots of guys sniffing around. Mary likes the look of a couple of young guys. Matthew Stewart, Earl of Lennox, handsome, he's got polished manners, having been in the Frenchy court for years. The other is Patrick Hepburn, Earl of Bothwell and Lord High Admiral of Scotland. A young, lusty gentleman, fair and pleasant in the sight of women. Just one problem. Bothwell is married with kiddies, but he's saying he'd be fine with a divorce if Mary would just have him. So the competition is down to these two guys. Mary, though, might be just stringing them both along. She knows the story of Margaret Tudor and how her second and third marriages to Scotty nobles ended up in strife and disaster. Now, Bothwell will agree that Mary has agreed to marry him. She hasn't, but Lennox will go off in a huff, and just as well. He's been rethinking the Frenchy thing, and he's writing to Henry. Our Henry, Henry Tudor, Henry VIII. Henry will make Lennox an offer he can't refuse, marriage to his naughty niece, Margaret Douglas. Lennox will pretend to be a good, loyal Scotty boy for a while, but his cover will be blamed when he intercepts a cargo of cash, artillery, 500 soldiers and 2 Frenchy ambassadors being sent to Mary. Bugger. Mary really needed that cash. Lennox, though, had been made a Frenchy citizen, so those ambassadors that were with the Frenchies will let him know that he's committing treason. So that'll calm him the fuck down. Plus, they say, we've been authorised by Mary of Guise to offer you a nice marriage to baby Mary once she comes of age. And there you go. Lennox is back on side for a bit. December 1543, and the Treaty of Greenwich will be torn up. Henry had broken it himself by stealing some Scottish ships. Then Mary will renew the old alliance with the Frenchies, and Henry is on the outer. Nice Christmas then for the Scotties, with Henry fuming in England. January 1544, and to make it worse for Henry, Henri in France, the dolphin, and Catherine de' Medici will announce the arrival of a brand new dolphin. Just a little bit of Stanley Jordan there to get us into some historical fiction, and this week I had a go at a book, King's Fool by Margaret Campbell. Just a nice little pleasant telling of the story of Henry VIII's fool, Will Summers. Real Will Summers had a long career for Henry VIII as his fool, and of course the King's Fool is the only guy who can really talk to the King and be fairly blunt about what the King may or may not be doing. Will Summers then was a bit like part of the family for Henry, I think, although at one stage Henry got pretty shitty with him and threatened to kill him. But Will Summers managed himself into a couple of family portraits that Henry had done. So, yeah, guess he was pretty successful. So a nice little read there, if you like. The King's Fool by Margaret Campbell. But for us, it's just a matter of what we go out with. And we got to babysit baby Henry Newman, and I wanted to introduce him to something other than classical, so I thought I might go to that Madridius, the Portugal outfit, because I love them. They're a lovely Sunday afternoon type outfit for you to put on your playlist. So let's have a go at Madridius and Ao Longa O Mar. Something about the sea there, I think. Hope to see you next week. Bye.